tell how close. Someone coming to kill him, and his terror-locked mind gave him a picture of the soldier with the switchblade in his neck, moving slowly toward him in the dark. The soft, gritting step again. Larry remembered the rifle. He threw the butt against his shoulder and began to fire. The explosions were shatteringly loud in the closed space. He screamed at the sound of them, but the scream was lost in the roar. Flashbulb images of tile and frozen lanes of traffic exploded one after another like a string of black-and-white snapshots as fire licked from the muzzle of the 30-30. Ricochets whined like banshees. The gun whacked his shoulder again and again until it was numb, until he knew that the force of the recoils had turned him on his feet and he was shooting out over the roadway instead of back along the catwalk. He was still unable to stop. His finger had taken over the function of the brain, and it spasmed mindlessly until the hammer began to fall with a dry and impotent clicking sound. The echoes rolled back. Bright afterimages hung before his eyes in triple exposures. He was faintly aware of the stench of cordite and of the whining sound he was making deep in his chest. Still clutching the gun, he whirled around again, and now it was not the soldiers in their sterile Andromeda-strained suits that he saw on the screen of his interior theater, but the Morlocks from the classic comics version of H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, humped and blind creatures coming out of their holes in the ground where engines ran on and on in the bowels of the earth. He began to struggle across the soft yet stiff barricade of bodies, stumbling, almost falling, clutching the railing, going on. His foot punched through into some dreadful sliminess, and there was a gassy, putrid smell that he barely noticed. He went on, gasping. Then from behind him, a scream rose in the darkness, freezing him on the spot. It was a desperate, wretched sound, close to the limits of sanity.
"Larry! Oh, Larry, for God's sake!"
It was Rita Blakemore. He turned around. There was sobbing now, wild sobbing that filled the place with fresh echoes. For one wild moment he decided to go on anyway, to leave her. She would find her way out eventually. Why burden himself with her again? Then he got hold of himself and shouted, "Rita! Stay where you are, do you hear me?" The sobbing continued. He stumbled back across the bodies, trying not to breathe, his face twisted in an expression of grimacing disgust. Then he ran toward her, not sure how far he had to go because of the distorting quality of the echo. In the end, he almost fell over her.
"Larry!"
She threw herself against him and clutched his neck with a strangler's force. He could feel her heart skidding along at a breakneck pace under her shirt.
"Larry, Larry, don't leave me alone here. Don't leave me alone in the dark."
"No." He held her tightly. "Did I hurt you? Are you shot?"
"No. I felt the wind. One of them went by so close I felt the wind of it. And chips, tile chips, I think, on my face. Cut my face."
"Oh, Jesus, Rita, I didn't know. I was freaking out in here, the dark, and I lost my lighter. You should have called. I could have killed you." The truth of it came home to him. "I could have killed you," he repeated in stunned revelation.
"I wasn't sure it was you. I went into an apartment house when you went down the ramp, and you came back and called, and I almost... but I couldn't. And then two men came after the rain started. I think they were looking for us, or for me. So I stayed where I was, and when they were gone I thought, maybe they're not gone, maybe they're hiding and looking for me, and I didn't dare go out until I started to think you'd get to the other side, and I'd never see you again, so I... Larry, you won't leave me, will you? You won't go away?"
"No," he said.
"I was wrong. What I said, that was wrong. You were right. I should have told you about the sandals. I mean the shoes. I'll eat when you tell me to. Oh!"
"Shh," he said, holding her. "It's all right now. All right." But in his mind he saw himself firing at her in a blind panic, and thought how easily one of those slugs could have smashed her arm or blown out her stomach. Suddenly he had to go to the bathroom very badly, and his teeth wanted to chatter. "We'll go when you feel like you can walk. Take your time."
"There was a man. I think it was a man. I stepped on him, Larry."
She swallowed, and her throat clicked.
Oh, I almost screamed then, but I didn't because I thought it might be one of those men up ahead instead of you. And when you called out, the echo, I couldn't tell if it was you or...
There are more dead people up ahead. Can you stand that?
If you're with me, please, if you're with me.
I will be.
Let's go, then. I want to get out of here.
She shuddered convulsively against him.
I never wanted anything so badly in my life.
He felt for her face and kissed her, first her nose, then each eye, then her mouth.
Thank you,
he said humbly, having not the slightest idea what he meant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, she repeated. Oh, dear Larry, you won't leave me, will you?
No, he said, I won't leave you. Just tell me when you feel like you can, Rita, and we'll go together. When she felt she could, they did. They got over the bodies, their arms slung about each other's necks like drunken chums coming home from a neighborhood tavern. Beyond that, they came to a blockage of some sort. It was impossible to see, but after running her hands over it, Rita said it might be a bed standing on end. Together, they managed to tip it over the catwalk railing. It crashed into a car below with a loud echoing bang that made them both jump and clutch each other. Behind where it had been, there were more sprawled bodies, three of them, and Larry guessed that these were the soldiers that had shot down the Jewish family. They got over them and went on, holding hands. A short time later, Rita stopped short.
"What's the matter?" Larry asked. "Is there something in the way?"
"No. I can see, Larry. It's the end of the tunnel."
He blinked and realized that he could see, too. The glow was dim, and it had come so gradually that he hadn't been aware of it until Rita had spoken. He could make out a faint shine on the tiles, and the pale blur of Rita's face closer by. Looking over to the left, he could see the dead river of automobiles. "Come on," he said, jubilant. 60 paces farther along, there were more bodies sprawled on the walkway, all soldiers. They stepped over them.
"Why would they only close off New York?" she asked. "Unless maybe... Larry, maybe it only happened in New York."
"I don't think so," he said, but felt a touch of irrational hope anyway. They walked faster. The mouth of the tunnel was ahead of them now. It was blocked by two huge army convoy trucks parked nose to nose. The trucks blotted out much of the daylight. If they hadn't been there, Larry and Rita would have had some light much farther back in the tunnel. There was another sprawl of bodies where the catwalk descended to join the ramp leading outside. They squeezed between the convoy trucks, scrambling over the locked bumpers. Rita didn't look inside, but Larry did. There was a half-assembled tripod machine gun, boxes of ammunition, and canisters of stuff that looked like tear gas. Also, three dead men. As they came outside, a rain-dampened breeze pressed against them, and its wonderfully fresh smell seemed to make it all worthwhile. He said so to Rita, and she nodded and put her head against his shoulder for a moment.
"I wouldn't go through there again for $1 million, though," she said.
"In a few years you'll be using money for toilet paper," he said. "Please don't squeeze the greenbacks."
"But are you sure
that it wasn't just New York?" He pointed. "Look." The toll booths were empty. The middle one stood in a heap of broken glass. Beyond them, the westbound lanes were empty for as far as they could see, but the eastbound lanes, the ones which fed into the tunnel and the city they had just left, were crowded with silent traffic. There was an untidy pile of bodies in the breakdown lane, and a number of seagulls stood watch over it.
"Oh, dear God," she said weakly.
"There were as many people trying to get into New York as there were trying to get out of it. I don't know why they bothered blockading the tunnel on the Jersey end. Probably they didn't know why either. Just somebody's bright idea. Busy work." But she had sat down on the road and was crying. "Don't," he said, kneeling beside her. The experience in the tunnel was still too fresh for him to feel angry with her. "It's all right, Rita."
"What is?" she sobbed. "What is? Just tell me one thing."
"We're out, anyway. That's something. And there's fresh air.
In fact, New Jersey never smelled so good. That earned him a wan smile. Larry looked at the scratches on her cheek and temple where the shards of tile had cut her.
"We ought to get you to a drugstore and put some peroxide on those cuts," he said. "Do you feel up to walking?"
"Yes."
She was looking at him with a dumb gratitude that made him feel uneasy.
"And I'll get some new shoes, some sneakers. I'll do just what you tell me, Larry. I want to."
"I shouted at you because I was upset," he said quietly. He brushed her hair back and kissed one of the scratches over her right eye. "I'm not such a bad guy," he added quietly.
"Just don't leave me."
He helped her to her feet and slipped an arm around her waist. Then they walked slowly toward the toll booths and slipped through them, New York behind them and across the river. Chapter 36. There was a small park in the center of Ogunquit, complete with a Civil War cannon and a war memorial. And after Gus Dinsmore died, Franny Goldsmith went there and sat beside the duck pond, idly throwing stones in and watching the ripples spread in the calm water until they reached the lily pads around the edges and broke up in confusion. She had taken Gus to the Hansen House down on the beach the day before yesterday, afraid that if she waited any longer, Gus wouldn't be able to walk and would have to spend his final confinement, as her ancestors would have termed it with such grisly yet apt euphemism, in his hot little cubicle near the public beach parking lot. She had thought Gus would die that night. His fever had been high, and he had been crazily delirious, falling out of bed twice and even staggering around old Mr. Hansen's bedroom, knocking things over, falling to his knees, getting up again. He cried out to people who were not there, answered them, and watched them with emotions varying from hilarity to dismay, until Franny began to feel that Gus's invisible companions were the real ones, and she was the phantom. She had begged Gus to get back into bed, but for Gus, she wasn't there. She had to keep stepping out of his way. If she hadn't, he would have knocked her over and walked over her. At last he had fallen onto the bed and had passed from energetic delirium to a gasping, heavy-breathing unconsciousness that Fran supposed was the final coma. But the next morning, when she looked in on him, Gus had been sitting up in bed and reading a paperback Western he had found on one of the shelves. He thanked her for taking care of him and told her earnestly that he hoped he hadn't said or done anything embarrassing the night before. When she said he hadn't, Gus had looked doubtfully around the wreckage of the bedroom and told her she was good to say so anyway. She made some soup, which she ate with gusto, and when he complained of how hard it was to read without his spectacles, which had been broken while he had been taking his turn on the barricade at the south end of town the week before, she had taken the paper back, over his weak protests, and had read him four chapters in a Western by that woman who lived up north in Haven. Rimfire Christmas, it was called. Sheriff John Stoner was having problems with the rowdier element in the town of Roaring Rock, Wyoming, it seemed. And worse, he just couldn't find anything to give his lovely young wife for Christmas. Fran had gone away more optimistic, thinking that Gus might be recovering. But last night he had been worse again, and he had died at 7:45 this morning, only an hour and a half ago. He had been rational at the end, but unaware of just how serious his condition was. He had told her longingly that he'd like to have an ice cream soda, the kind his daddy had treated Gus and his brothers to every 4th of July and again at Labor Day when the fair came to Bangor. But the power was off in Ogunquit by then. It had gone at exactly 9:17 p.m. on the evening of June 28th by the electric clocks. And there was no ice cream to be had in town. She had wondered if someone in town might not have a gasoline generator with a freezer hooked up to it on an emergency circuit, and even thought of hunting up Harold Lauder to ask him. But then Gus began to breathe his final, whooping, hopeless breaths. That went on for 5 minutes, while she held his head up with one hand and a cloth under his mouth with the other to catch the thick expectorations of mucus. Then it was over. Franny covered him with a clean sheet and had left him on old Jack Hansen's bed, which overlooked the ocean. Then she had come here, and since then had been skipping rocks across the pond, not thinking about much of anything. But she unconsciously realized that it was a good kind of not thinking.
It wasn't like that strange apathy that had shrouded her on the day after her father had died. Since then, she had been more and more herself. She had gotten a rose bush down at Nathan's house of flowers and had carefully planted it at the foot of Peter's grave. She thought it would take hold real well, as her father would have said. Her lack of thought now was a kind of rest, after seeing Gus through the last of it. It was nothing like the prelude to madness she had gone through before. That had been like passing through some gray, foul tunnel full of shapes more sensed than seen. It was a tunnel she never wanted to travel again. But she would have to think soon about what to do next, and she supposed that thinking would have to include Harold Lauder. Not just because she and Harold were now the last two people in the area, but because she had no idea what would become of Harold without someone to watch out for him. She didn't suppose that she was the world's most practical person, but since she was here, she would have to do. She still didn't particularly like him, but at least he had tried to be tactful and had turned out to have some decency. Quite a bit, even, in his own queer way. Harold had left her alone since their meeting 4 days ago, probably respecting her wish to grieve for her parents. But she had seen him from time to time in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac, cruising aimlessly from place to place. And twice, when the wind was right, she had been able to hear the clacking of his typewriter from her bedroom window. The fact that it was quiet enough to hear that sound, although the Lauder house was nearly a mile and a half away, seemed to underline the reality of what had happened. She was a little amused that although Harold had latched onto the Cadillac, he hadn't thought of replacing his manual typewriter with one of those quiet, humming electric torpedoes. Not that he could have it now, she thought as she stood up and brushed off the seat of her shorts. Ice cream and electric typewriters were things of the past. It made her feel sadly nostalgic, and she found herself wondering again with a sense of deep bewilderment how such a cataclysm could have taken place in only a couple of weeks. There would be other people, no matter what Harold said. If the system of authority had temporarily broken down, they would just have to find the scattered others and reform it. It didn't occur to her to wonder why authority seemed to be such a necessary thing to have, any more than it occurred to her to wonder why she had automatically felt responsible for Harold. It just was. Structure was a necessary thing. She left the park and walked slowly down Main Street toward the Lauder house. The day was warm already, but the air was freshened by a sea breeze. She suddenly wanted to go down to the beach, find a nice piece of kelp, and nibble on it. "God, you're disgusting," she said aloud. Of course she wasn't disgusting. She was just pregnant. That was it. Next week it would be Bermuda onion sandwiches, with creamy horseradish on top. She stopped on the corner, still a block from Harold's, surprised at how long it had been since she had thought of her delicate condition. Before, she had always been discovering that "I'm pregnant" thought around odd corners, like some unpleasant mess she kept forgetting to clean up. "I ought to be sure and get that blue dress to the cleaners before Friday. A few more months and I can hang it in the closet because I'm pregnant. I guess I'll take my shower now. In a few months it'll look like there's a whale in the shower stall because I'm pregnant. I ought to get the oil changed in the car before the pistons fall right out of their sockets or whatever. And I wonder what Johnny down at the Sitco would say if he knew I'm pregnant." But maybe now she had become accustomed to the thought. After all, she was nearly 3 months along, nearly a third of the way there. For the first time, she wondered with some unease who would help her have her baby. From behind the Lauder house there came a steady ratcheting click-click-click of a hand mower, and when Fran came around the corner, what she saw was so strange that only her complete surprise kept her from laughing out loud. Harold, clad only in a tight and skimpy blue bathing suit, was mowing the lawn. His white skin was sheened with sweat. His long hair flopped against his neck, although to do Harold credit, it did appear to have been washed in the not-too-distant past. The rolls of fat above the waistband of his trunks and below the leg bands jounced up and down wildly. His feet were green with cut grass to above the ankle. His back had gone reddish, although with exertion or incipient sunburn, she couldn't tell. But Harold wasn't just mowing. He was running. The Lauder's back lawn sloped down to a picturesque rambling stone wall, and in the middle of it was an octagonal summer house. She and Amy used to hold their teas there when they were little girls, Franny remembered with a sudden stab of nostalgia that was unexpectedly painful. Back in the days when they could still cry over the ending of Charlotte's Web and moan happily over Chucky Mayo, the cutest boy in school. The Lauder's lawn was somehow English in its greenness and peace, but now a dervish in a blue bathing suit had invaded this pastoral scene. She could hear Harold panting in a way that was alarming to listen to as he turned the northeast corner where the Lauder's back lawn was divided from the Wilson's by a row of mulberry bushes. He roared down the slope of the lawn, bent over the mower's T-handle. The blades whirred. Grass flew in a green jet, coating Harold's lower legs. He had mowed perhaps half of the lawn. What was left was a diminishing square with the summer house in the middle. He turned the corner at the bottom of the hill and then roared back, for a moment obscured from view by the summer house, and then reappearing, bent over his machine like a Formula One race driver. About halfway up, he saw her. At exactly the same instant, Franny said timidly, "Harold?" And she saw that he was in tears. "Huh," Harold said, squeaked, actually. She had startled him out of some private world, and for a moment she feared that the startle on top of his exertion would give him a heart attack. Then he ran for the house, his feet kicking through drifts of mown grass, and she was peripherally aware of the sweet smell it made on the hot summer air. She took a step after him. "Harold, what's wrong?" Then he was bounding up the porch steps. The back door opened, Harold ran inside, and it slammed behind him with a jarring crash. In the silence that descended afterward, a jay called stridently, and some small animal made rattling noises in the bushes behind the stone wall. The mower, abandoned, stood with cut grass behind it and high grass before it a little way from the summer house where she and Amy had once drunk their Kool-Aid in Barbie's kitchen cups, with their little fingers sticking elegantly off into the air. Franny stood indecisive for a while, and at last walked up to the door and knocked. There was no answer, but she could hear Harold crying somewhere inside. "Harold?" No answer. The weeping went on. She let herself into the Lauder's back hall, which was dark, cool, and fragrant. Mrs. Lauder's cold pantry opened off the hall to the left, and for as long as Franny could remember, there had been the good smell of dried apples and cinnamon back here, like pies dreaming of creation. "Harold?" She walked up the hall to the kitchen, and Harold was there, sitting at the table. His hands were clutched in his hair, and his green feet rested on the faded linoleum that Mrs. Lauder had kept so spotless. "Harold, what's wrong?"
"Go away," he yelled tearfully. "Go away, you don't like me."
"Yes, I do. You're okay, Harold. Maybe not great, but okay." She paused. "In fact, considering the circumstances and all, I'd have to say that right now you're one of my favorite people in the whole world." This seemed to make Harold cry harder.
"Do you have anything to drink?"
"Kool-Aid," he said. He sniffed, wiped his nose, and, still looking at the table, added, "It's warm." "Of course it is. Did you get the water at the town pump?" Like many small towns, Agunquit still had a common pump in back of the town hall, although for the last 40 years it had been more of an antiquity than a practical source of water. Tourists sometimes took pictures of it. "This is the town pump in the little seaside town where we spent our vacation. Oh, isn't that quaint?"
"Yeah, that's where I got it."
She poured them each a glass and sat down. "We should be having it in the summer house," she thought. "We could drink it with our little fingers sticking off into the air."
"Harold, what's wrong?"
Harold uttered a strange hysterical laugh and fumbled his Kool-Aid to his mouth. He drained the glass and set it down.
"Wrong? Now what could be wrong?"
"I mean, is it something specific?" She tasted her Kool-Aid and fought down a grimace. It wasn't that warm. Harold must have drawn the water only a short time ago, but he had forgotten the sugar. He looked up at her finally, his face tear-streaked and still wanting to blubber.
"I want my mother," he said simply.
"Oh, Harold. I thought when it happened, when she died. Now that wasn't so bad." He was gripping his glass, staring at her in an intense, haggard way that was a little frightening. I know how terrible that must sound to you, but I never knew how I would take it when they passed away. I'm a very sensitive person. That's why I was so persecuted by the cretins at that house of horrors the town fathers saw fit to call a high school. I thought it might drive me mad with grief, their passing, or at least prostrate me for a year. My interior son, so to speak, would... And when it happened, my mother, Amy, my father, I said to myself, now that wasn't so bad. He brought his fist down on the table, making her flinch. Why can't I say what I mean? He screamed. I've always been able to say what I mean. It's a writer's job to carve with language, to hew close to the bone. So why can't I say what it feels like?
Harold, don't. I know how you feel.
He stared at her, dumbstruck.
You know.
He shook his head.
No, you couldn't.
Remember when you came to the house and I was digging the grave? I was half out of my mind. Half the time I couldn't even remember what I was doing. I tried to cook some French fries and almost burned the house down. So if it makes you feel better to mow the grass, fine. You'll get a sunburn if you do it in your bathing trunks, though. You're already getting one, she added critically, looking at his shoulders. To be polite, she sipped a little more of the dreadful Kool-Aid. He wiped his hands across his mouth. I never even liked them that well, he said, but I thought grief was something you felt anyway. Like your bladder's full, you have to urinate. And if close relatives die, you have to be grief-stricken. She nodded, thinking that was strange, but not inapt. My mother was always taken with Amy. She was Amy's friend, he amplified with unconscious and nearly pitiful childishness. And I horrified my father. Fran saw how that could be. Brad Lauder had been a huge brawny man, a foreman at the woolen mill in Kennebunk. He would have had very little idea of what to make of the fat, peculiar son that his loins had produced. He took me aside once, Harold resumed, and asked me if I was a queer boy. That's just how he said it. I got so scared I cried, and he slapped my face and told me if I was going to be such a goddamn baby all the time, I'd best ride right out of town. And Amy, I think it would be safe to say that Amy just didn't give a shit. I was just an embarrassment when she brought her friends home. She treated me like I was a messy room. With an effort, Fran finished her Kool-Aid. So when they were gone and I didn't feel too much one way or the other, I just thought I was wrong. Grief is not a knee-jerk reaction, I said to myself. But I got fooled. I missed them more and more every day, mostly my mother. If I could just see her. A lot of times she wasn't around when I wanted her, needed her. She was too busy doing things for Amy or with Amy, but she was never mean to me. So this morning when I got thinking about it, I said to myself, I'll mow the grass, then I won't think about it. But I did, and I started to mow faster and faster, as if I could outrun it, and I guess that's when you came in. Did I look as crazy as I felt, Fran? She reached across the table and touched his hand. There's nothing wrong with the way you feel, Harold. Are you sure? He was looking at her again in that wide-eyed, childish stare. Yes. Will you be my friend? Yes. Thank God, Harold said. Thank God for that. His hand was sweaty in hers, and as she thought it, he seemed to sense it and pulled his hand reluctantly away. Would you like some more Kool-Aid? He asked her humbly. She smiled her best diplomatic smile. Maybe later, she said. They had a picnic lunch in the park, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, Hostess Twinkies, and a large bottle of Coke each. The Cokes were fine after they had been cooled in the duck pond. I've been thinking about what I'm going to do, Harold said. Don't you want the rest of that Twinkie?
No, I'm full.
Her Twinkie disappeared into Harold's mouth in a single bite. His belated grief hadn't affected his appetite, Franny observed, and then decided that was a rather mean way to think.
What? She said.
I was thinking of going to Vermont, he said diffidently. Would you like to come?
Why Vermont?
There's a government plague and communicable diseases center there in a town called Stovington. It's not as big as the one in Atlanta, but it's sure a lot closer. I was thinking that if there were still people alive and working on this flu, a lot of them would be there.
Why wouldn't they be dead, too?
Well, they might be. They might be, Harold said rather prissily. But in places like Stovington, where they're used to dealing with communicable diseases, they're also used to taking precautions. And if they are still in operation, I would imagine they are looking for people like us, people who are immune.
How do you know all that, Harold?
She was looking at him with open admiration, and Harold blushed happily.
I read a lot. Neither of those places are secret.
So what do you think, Fran?
She thought it was a wonderful idea. It appealed to that uncoalesced need for structure and authority. She immediately dismissed Harold's disclaimer that the people running such an institution might all be dead. They would get to Stovington, they would be taken in, tested, and out of all the tests would come some discrepancy, some difference between them and all the people who had gotten sick and died. It didn't occur to her just then to wonder what earthly good a vaccine could do at this point.
"I think we ought to find a road atlas and see how to get there yesterday," she said.
His face lit up. For a moment she thought he was going to kiss her, and in that single shining moment she probably would have allowed it, but then the moment passed. In retrospect, she was glad. By the road atlas, where all distance was reduced to finger lengths, it looked simple enough. Number 1 to I-95, I-95 to US 302, and then northwest on 302 through the lake country towns of western Maine, across the Chimney of New Hampshire on the same road, and then into Vermont. Stovington was only 30 miles west of Barrie, accessible either by Vermont Route 61 or I-89.
"How far is that altogether?" Fran asked.
Harold got a ruler, measured, and then consulted the mileage scale.
"You won't believe this," he said glumly.
"What is it, 100 miles?
"Over 300.
"Oh, God," Franny said. "That kills my idea. I read somewhere that you could walk through most of the New England states in a single day."
"It's a gimmick," Harold said in his most scholarly voice. "It is possible to walk in 4 states, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and just across the Vermont state line, in 24 hours, if you do it in just the right way. But it's like solving that puzzle where you have 2 interlocked nails. It's easy if you know how, impossible if you don't."
"Where in the world did you get that?" she asked, amused.
"Guinness Book of World Records," he said disdainfully, "otherwise known as the Agunquit High School Study Hall Bible. Actually, I was thinking of bikes. Or, I don't know, maybe motor scooters."
"Harold," she said solemnly, "you're a genius."
Harold coughed, blushing and pleased again.
"We could bike as far as Wells tomorrow morning. There's a Honda dealership there. Can you drive a Honda, Fran?"
"I can learn if we can go slow for a while."
"Oh, I think it would be very unwise to speed," Harold said seriously. "One would never know when one might come around a blind curve and find a 3-car smash-up blocking the road."
"No, one never would one. But why wait until tomorrow? Why don't we go today?"
"Well, it's past 2 now, he said. "We couldn't get much farther than Wells, and we'd need to outfit ourselves. That would be easier to do here in Agunquit, because we know where everything is. And we'll need guns, of course."
It was queer, really. As soon as he mentioned that word, she had thought of the baby.
"Why do we need guns?"
He looked at her for a moment, then dropped his eyes. A red blush was creeping up his neck.
"Because the police and courts are gone, and you're a woman and you're pretty, and some people, some men, might not be gentlemen. That's why."
His blush was so red now it was almost purple.
"He's talking about rape," she thought.
"Rape? But how could anybody want to rape me? I'm pregnant."
But no one knew that, not even Harold.
"And even if you spoke up, said to the intended rapist, 'Will you please not do that because I'm pregnant?' Could you reasonably expect the rapist to reply, 'Cheese, lady, I'm sorry, I'll go rape some other goyle?'"
"All right," she said, "guns. But we could still get as far as Wells today."
"There's something else I want to do here," Harold said. The cupola atop Moses Richardson's barn was explosively hot. Sweat had been trickling down her body by the time they got to the hayloft, but by the time they reached the top of the rickety flight of stairs leading from the loft to the cupola, it was coursing down her body in rivers, darkening her blouse and molding it to her breasts.
"Do you really think this is necessary, Harold?"
"I don't know." He was carrying a bucket of white paint and a wide brush with the protective cellophane still on it.
"But the barn overlooks US-1, and that's the way most people would come, I think. Anyway, it can't hurt."
"It will hurt if you fall off and break your bones." The heat was making her head ache, and her lunchtime Coke was sloshing around her stomach in a way that was extremely nauseating. "In fact, it would be the end of you."
"I won't fall," Harold said nervously. He glanced at her. "Fran, you look sick."
"It's the heat," she said faintly.
"Then go downstairs, for goodness sake. Lie under a tree, watch the human fly as he does his death-defying act on the precipitous 10-degree slope of Moses Richardson's barn roof."
"Don't joke. I still think it's silly and dangerous."
"Yes, but I'll feel better if I go through with it. Go on, Fran."
She thought, "Why, he's doing it for me." He stood there, sweaty and scared, old cobwebs clinging to his naked, blubbery shoulders, his belly cascading over the waistband of his tight blue jeans, determined not to miss a bet, to do all the right things. She stood on tiptoe and kissed his mouth lightly.
"You be careful," she said,
and then went quickly down the stairs with the Coke sloshing in her belly, up, down, all around. Yeek! She went quickly, but not so quickly that she didn't see the stunned happiness come up in his eyes. She went down the nailed rungs from the hayloft to the straw-littered barn floor even faster because she knew she was going to puke now. And while she knew that it was the heat and the Coke and the baby, what might Harold think if he heard? So she wanted to get outside where he couldn't hear. And she made it. Just. Harold came down at 4:15, his sunburn now flaming red, his arms splattered with white paint. Fran had napped uneasily under an elm in Richardson's dooryard while he worked, never quite going under completely, listening for the rattle of shingles giving way and poor fat Harold's despairing scream as he fell the 90 feet from the barn's roof to the hard ground below. But it never came, thank God. And now he stood proudly before her, lawn green feet, white arms, red shoulders.
"Why did you bother to bring the paint back down?" she asked him curiously.
"I wouldn't want to leave it up there. It might lead to spontaneous combustion, and we'd lose our sign." And she thought again how determined he was not to miss a single bet. It was just a little bit scary. They both gazed up at the barn roof. The fresh paint gleamed out in sharp contrast to the faded green shingles, and the words painted there reminded Fran of the signs you sometimes came upon down south, painted across barn roofs. "Jesus Saves," or "Chew Red Indian." Harold's read, "Have gone to Stovington, Vermont Plague Center, US-1 to Wells, Interstate 95 to Portland, US-302 to Barry, Interstate 89 to Stovington. Leaving Ogunquit, July 2, 1990. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith."
"I didn't know your middle name," Harold said apologetically.
"That's fine," Franny said, still looking up at the sign. The first line had been written just below the cupola window, the last, her name, just above the rain gutter.
"How did you get that last line on?" she asked.
"It wasn't hard," he said self-consciously. "I had to dangle my feet over a little, that's all."
"Oh, Harold, why couldn't you have just signed for yourself?"
"Because we're a team," he said, and then looked at her a little apprehensively.
"Aren't we?"
"I guess we are, as long as you don't kill yourself."
"Hungry?"
He beamed.
"Hungry as a bear."
"Then let's go eat. And I'll put some baby oil on your sunburn. You're just going to have to wear your shirt, Harold. You won't be able to sleep on that tonight."
"I'll sleep fine," he said, and smiled at her.
Franny smiled back. They ate a supper of canned food and Kool-Aid. Franny made it and added sugar. And later, when it had begun to get dark, Harold came over to Fran's house with something under his arm.
"It was Amy's," he said. "I found it in the attic. I think Mom and Dad gave it to her when she graduated from junior high. I don't even know if it still works, but I got some batteries from the hardware store."
He patted his pockets, which were bulging with ever-ready batteries. It was a portable phonograph, the kind with the plastic cover, invented for teenage girls of 13 or 14 to take to beach and lawn parties. The kind of phonograph constructed with 45 singles in mind, the ones made by the Osmonds, Leif Garrett, John Travolta, Sean Cassidy. She looked at it closely and felt her eyes filling with tears. "Well," she said, "let's see if it does." It did work, and for almost 4 hours they sat at the opposite ends of the couch, the portable phonograph on the coffee table before them, their faces lit with silent and sorrowful fascination, listening as the music of a dead world filled the summer night. Chapter 37. At first, Stu accepted the sound without question. It was such a typical part of a bright summer morning. He had just passed through the town of South Reigate, New Hampshire, and now the highway wound through a pretty country of overhanging elms that dappled the road with coins of moving sunlight. The underbrush on either side was thick, bright sumac, blue-gray juniper, lots of bushes he couldn't name. The profusion of them was still a wonder to his eyes, accustomed as they were to East Texas, where the roadside flora had nothing like this variety. On the left, an ancient rock wall meandered in and out of the brush, and on the right a small brook gurgled cheerily east. Every now and then small animals would move in the underbrush. Yesterday he had been transfixed by the sight of a large doe standing on the white line of 302, scenting the morning air, and birds called raucously. And against that background of sound, the barking dog sounded like the most natural thing in the world. He walked almost another mile before it occurred to him that the dog, closer now by the sound, might be out of the ordinary after all. He had seen a great many dead dogs since leaving Stovington, but no live ones. Well, he supposed the flu had killed most but not all of the people. Apparently it had killed most but not all of the dogs as well. Probably it would be extremely people-shy by now. When it scented him, it would most likely crawl back into the bushes and bark hysterically at him until Stu left its territory. He adjusted the straps of the Day-Glo pack he was wearing and refolded the handkerchiefs that lay under the straps at each shoulder. He was wearing a pair of Georgia Giants, and 3 days of walking had rubbed most of the new from them. On his head was a jaunty, wide-brimmed red felt hat, and there was an army carbine slung across his shoulder. He did not expect to run across marauders, but he had a vague idea that it might be a good idea to have a gun. Fresh meat, maybe. Well, he had seen fresh meat yesterday still on the hoof, and he had been too amazed and pleased to even think about shooting it. The pack riding easily again, he went on up the road. The dog sounded as if it was just beyond the next bend. Maybe I'll see him after all, Stu thought. He had picked up 302 going east because he supposed that sooner or later it would take him to the ocean. He had made a kind of compact with himself. When I get to the ocean, I'll decide what I'm going to do. Until then, I won't think about it at all. His walk, now in its fourth day, had been a kind of healing process. He had thought about taking a 10-speed bike or maybe a motorcycle with which he could thread his way through the occasional crashes that blocked the road, but instead had decided to walk. He had always enjoyed hiking, and his body cried out for exercise. Until his escape from Stovington, he had been cooped up for nearly 2 weeks, and he felt flabby and out of shape. He supposed that sooner or later his slow progress would make him impatient and he would get the bike or motorcycle. But for now he was content to hike east on this road, looking at whatever he wanted to look at, taking 5 when he wanted to, or in the afternoon dropping off for a snooze during the hottest part of the day. It was good for him to be doing this. Little by little, the lunatic search for a way out was fading into memory, just something that had happened instead of a thing so vivid it brought cold sweat out onto his skin. The memory of that feeling of someone following him had been the hardest to shake. The first 2 nights on the road he had dreamed again and again of his final encounter with Elder, when Elder had come to carry out his orders. In the dreams, Stu was always too slow with the chair. Elder stepped back out of its arc, pulled the trigger of his pistol, and Stu felt a heavy but painless boxing glove weighted with lead shot land on his chest. He dreamed this over and over until he woke unrested in the morning, but so glad to be alive that he hardly realized it. Last night the dream hadn't come. He doubted if the Willies would stop all at once, but he thought he might be walking the poison out of his system little by little. Maybe he would never get rid of all of it, but when most of it was gone he felt sure he would be able to think better about what came next, whether he had reached the ocean by then or not. He came around the bend and there was the dog, an auburn-colored Irish setter. It barked joyously at the sight of Stu and ran up the road, toenails clicking on the composition surface, tail wagging frantically back and forth. It jumped up, placing its forepaws on Stu's belly, and its forward motion made him stagger back a step. "Whoa, boy," he said, grinning. The dog barked happily at the sound of his voice and leaped up again. "Kojak," a stern voice said, and Stu jumped and stared around. "Get down, leave that man alone. You're going to track all over his shirt, miserable dog." Kojak put all 4 feet on the road again and walked around Stu with his tail between his legs. The tail was still flipping back and forth in suppressed joy despite its confinement, however, and Stu decided this one would never make much of a canine put-on artist. Now he could see the owner of the voice, and of Kojak, it seemed like. A man of about 60 wearing a ragged sweater, old gray pants, and a beret. He was sitting on a piano stool and holding a palette. An easel with a canvas on it stood before him. Now he stood up, placed the palette on the piano stool. Under his breath, Stu heard him mutter, "Now don't forget and sit on that," and walked toward Stu with his hand extended. Beneath the beret, his fluffy grayish hair bounced in a small and mellow breeze. "I hope you intend no foul play with that rifle, sir. Glenn Bateman, at your service." Stu stepped forward and took the outstretched hand. Kojak was growing frisky again, bouncing around Stu but not daring to renew his leaps, not yet at least. "Stuart Redman, don't worry about the gun. I ain't seen enough people to start shooting them. In fact, I ain't seen any until you." "Do you like caviar?" "Never tried it." "Then it's time you did. And if you don't care for it, there's plenty of other things. Kojak, don't jump. I know you're thinking of renewing your crazed leaps. I can read you like a book, but control yourself. Always remember, Kojak, that control is what separates the higher orders from the lower. Control." His better nature thus appealed to, Kojak shrank down on his haunches and began to pant. He had a big grin on his doggy face. It had been Stu's experience that a grinning dog is either a biting dog or a damned good dog, and this didn't look like a biting dog. "I'm inviting you to lunch," Bateman said. "You're the first human being I've seen, at least in the last week. Will you stay?" "I'd be glad to." "Southerner, aren't you?"
"East Texas."
"An Easterner. My mistake." Bateman cackled at his own wit and turned back to his picture, an indifferent watercolor of the woods across the road.
"I wouldn't sit down on that piano stool if I were you," Stu said.
"Shit, no. Wouldn't do at all, would it?" He changed course and headed toward the back of the small clearing. Stu saw there was an orange and white cooler chest in the shade back there with what looked like a white lawn tablecloth folded on top of it. When Bateman fluffed it out, Stu saw that was just what it was.
"Used to be part of the communion set at the Grace Baptist Church in Woodsville," Bateman said. "I liberated it. I don't think the Baptists will miss it. They've all gone home to Jesus. At least all the Woodsville Baptists have. They can celebrate their communion in person now, although I think the Baptists are going to find heaven a great letdown unless the management allows them television, or perhaps they'll call it Heaven Vision up there, on which they can watch Jerry Falwell and Jack Van Impe. What we have here is an old pagan communing with nature instead. Kojak, don't step on the tablecloth. Control. Always remember that, Kojak. In all you do, make control your watchword. Shall we step across the road and have a wash, Mr. Redman?"
"Make it Stew."
"All right, I will."
They went down the road and washed in the cold, clear water. Stew felt happy. Meeting this particular man at this particular time seemed somehow exactly right. Downstream from them, Kojak lapped at the water and then bounded off into the woods, barking happily. He flushed a wood pheasant, and Stew watched it explode up from the brush and thought with some surprise, that just maybe everything would be all right. Somehow, all right.
He didn't care much for the caviar. It tasted like cold fish jelly. But Bateman also had a pepperoni, a salami, two tins of sardines, some slightly mushy apples, and a large box of Keebler fig bars. Wonderful for the bowels, fig bars, Bateman said. Stu's bowels had been giving him no grief at all since he'd gotten out of Stovington and started walking, but he liked the fig bars anyway, and helped himself to half a dozen. In fact, he ate hugely of everything. During the meal, which was eaten largely on saltines, Bateman told Stu he had been an assistant professor of sociology at Woodsville Community College. Woodsville, he said, was a small town, famous for its community college and its four gas stations, he told Stu, another 6 miles down the road. His wife had been dead 10 years. They had been childless. Most of his colleagues had not cared for him, he said, and the feeling had been heartily mutual. They thought I was a lunatic, he said. The strong possibility that they were right did nothing to improve our relations. He had accepted the superflu epidemic with equanimity, he said, because at last he would be able to retire and paint full time, as he had always wanted to do. As he divided the dessert, a Sara Lee pound cake, and handed Stu his half on a paper plate, he said, I'm a horrible painter, horrible, but I simply tell myself that this July there is no one on earth painting better landscapes than Glendon Pequod Bateman, B-A-M-A-M-F-A. A cheap ego trip, but mine own. Was Kojak your dog before? No. That would have been a rather amazing coincidence, wouldn't it? I believe Kojak belonged to someone across town. I saw him occasionally, but since I didn't know what his name was, I have taken the liberty of rechristening him. He doesn't seem to mind. Excuse me for a minute, Stu. He trotted across the road, and Stu heard him splashing in the water. He came back shortly, pants legs rolled to his knees. He was carrying a dripping six-pack of Narragansett beer in each hand. This was supposed to go with the meal, stupid of me. It goes just as well after, Stu said, pulling a can off the template. Thanks. They pulled their ring tabs and Bateman raised his can. To us, Stu, may we have happy days, satisfied minds, and little or no low back pain.
Amen to that.
They clicked their cans together and drank. Stu thought that a swallow of beer had never tasted so good to him before and probably never would again. You're a man of few words, Bateman said. I hope you don't feel that I'm dancing on the grave of the world, so to speak. No, Stu said. I was prejudiced against the world, Bateman said. I admit that freely. The world in the last quarter of the 20th century had, for me at least, all the charm of an 80-year-old man dying of cancer of the colon. They say it's a malaise which has struck all Western peoples as the century, any century, draws to a close. We have always wrapped ourselves in mourning shrouds and gone around crying, Woe to thee, O Jerusalem! Or Cleveland, as the case may be. The dancing sickness took place during the latter part of the 15th century. Bubonic plague, the Black Death, decimated Europe near the end of the 14th. Whooping cough near the end of the 17th, and the first known outbreaks of influenza near the end of the 19th. We've become so used to the idea of the flu, it seems almost like the common cold to us, doesn't it, that no one but the historians seems to know that 100 years ago it didn't exist. It's during the last 3 decades of any given century that your religious maniacs arise with facts and figures showing that Armageddon is finally at hand. Such people are always there, of course, but near the end of a century their ranks seem to swell, and they are taken seriously by great numbers of people. Monsters appear. Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, Jack the Ripper, Lizzie Borden, Charles Manson and Richard Speck and Ted Bundy in our own time, if you like. It's been suggested by colleagues even more fanciful than I that Western man needs an occasional high colonic, a purging, and this occurs at the end of centuries so that he can face the new century clean and full of optimism. And in this case, we've been given a super enema. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense. We are not, after all, simply approaching the centenary this time. We are approaching a whole new millennium. Bateman paused, considering. Now that I think about it, I am dancing on the grave of the world. Another beer?
Stu took one and thought over what Bateman had said.
"It's not really the end," he said at last. "At least I don't think so, just intermission."
"Rather apt. Well said. I'm going back to my picture, if you don't mind."
"Go ahead."
"Have you seen any other dogs?" Bateman asked as Kojak came bounding joyously back across the road.
"No."
"Nor have I. You're the only other person I've seen, but Kojak seems to be one of a kind."
"If he's alive, there will be others."
"Not very scientific," Bateman said kindly. "What kind of an American are you? Show me a second dog, preferably a bitch, and I'll accept your thesis that somewhere there is a third. But don't show me one and from that posit a second. It won't do."
"I've seen cows," Stu said thoughtfully.
"Cows, yes, and deer, but the horses are all dead."
"You know that's right," Stu agreed.
He had seen several dead horses on his walk. In some cases, cows had been grazing upwind of the bloating bodies.
"Now why should that be?"
"No idea. We all respire in much the same way, and this seems to be primarily a respiratory disease. But I wonder if there isn't some other factor. Men, dogs, and horses catch it. Cows and deer don't. And rats were down for a while, but now seem to be coming back."
Bateman was recklessly mixing paint on his palette.
"Cats everywhere, a plague of cats. And from what I can see, the insects are going on pretty much as they always have. Of course, the little faux pas mankind commits rarely seem to affect them anyway, and the thought of a mosquito with the flu is just too ridiculous to consider. None of it makes any surface sense. It's crazy."
"It sure is," Stu said, and uncorked another beer. His head was buzzing pleasantly.
"We're apt to see some interesting shifts in the ecology," Bateman said. He was making the horrible mistake of trying to paint Kojak into his picture. "Remains to be seen if Homo sapiens is going to be able to reproduce himself in the wake of this. It very much remains to be seen. But at least we can get together and try. But is Kojak going to find a mate? Is he ever going to become a proud papa?"
"Jesus, I guess he might not."
Bateman stood, put his palette on his piano stool, and got a fresh beer.
"I think you're right," he said. "There probably are other people, other dogs, other horses, but many of the animals may die without ever reproducing. There may be some animals of those susceptible species who were pregnant when the flu came along, of course. There may be dozens of healthy women in the United States right now who, pardon the crudity, have cakes baking in the oven. But some of the animals are apt to just sink below the point of no return. If you take the dogs out of the equation, the deer, who seem immune, are going to run wild. Certainly there aren't enough men left around to keep the deer population down. Hunting season is going to be canceled for a few years."
"Well," Stu said, "the surplus deer will just starve."
"No, they won't. Not all of them. Not even most of them. Not up here, anyway. I can't speak for what might happen in East Texas, but in New England all the gardens were planted and growing nicely before this flu happened. The deer will have plenty to eat this year and next. Even after that, our crops will germinate wild. There won't be any starving deer for maybe as long as 7 years. If you come back this way in a few years, Stu, you'll have to elbow deer out of your way to get up the road."
Stu worked this over in his mind. Finally, he said, "Aren't you exaggerating?"
"Not on purpose. There may be a factor or factors I haven't taken into consideration, but I honestly don't think so. And we could take my hypothesis about the effect of the complete or almost complete subtraction of the dog population on the deer population and apply it to the relationships between other species. Cats breeding without check. What does that mean?"
"Well," I said, "rats were down on the ecological exchange but making a comeback. If there are enough cats, that may change. A world without rats sounds good at first, but I wonder."
"What did you mean when you said whether or not people could reproduce themselves was open to question?"
"There are two possibilities," Bateman said, "at least two that I see now. The first is that the babies may not be immune."
"You mean die as soon as they get into the world?"
"Yes, or possibly in utero."
"Less likely, but still possible. The superflu may have had some sterility effect on those of us that are left."
"That's crazy," Stu said.
"So's the mumps," Glenn Bateman said dryly.
But if the mothers of the babies that are in utero, if the mothers are immune...
Yes, in some cases immunities can be passed on from mother to child, just as susceptibilities can. But not in all cases. You just can't bank on it. I think the